Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Red Light Podcast Redux. I am your host, Gina Savage. I'm joined today, I'm going to give you a whole list of credits. First, I want to welcome our WROM radio listeners in Detroit, internet users worldwide, however many they are, and subscribers. But in the Red Room today, very funny man I've known for a number of years, who I'm going to get to know better today. You will too, but I'm going to give you a long list of his credits. This is like, he's in every commercial you've ever seen. Let's start there. And you're like, I don't know that guy, but he's everywhere. He's been on The Sopranos, Inside Man, Blue Bloods, Law and Order, NBC's The Blacklist, Sorcerer's Apprentice, Fringe, The Taking of Pelham 123. He's a writer, director, producer. He's got his own couple of films. One he's going to talk about at length today, The Stock Room. Please, if we could applaud the three people in the room. Ladies and gentlemen, Victor Cruz in the building.
You know, there's nothing wrong with just three people in the room. You know, when you first start doing stand-up comedy, that's what you got. You know, you got three people in the room.
Yeah.
And you got to give them a good show.
You got to give them a good show.
Because they showed up for you. And guess what? That's all that freaking matters.
That's right. Hey, it really, you know, I want to add a couple things that you didn't even realize you did. Can I tell you what else you did? You are Victor Cruz. You have Victor Cruz Inc. You have Victor. Well, you know you did these. Victor Cruz. You know you did it. You have Victor Cruz Inc. Victor Cruz Experience. Victor Cruz Entertainment. Victor Cruz Acting Class.
Yeah, yeah.
You also have Victor Cruz Home Designs. Victor Cruz Auto Body Shop. Victor Cruz Veterinary Clinic. And Victor Cruz Flower Shop. I found those. Yeah. I mean, what the freak, man? How many things do you do? I had no idea you did. I mean, I knew, but I didn't know.
Yeah, the last couple ones you mentioned, I don't remember doing
those. The Auto Body Shop?
The Auto Body Shop, but it does make sense because I am from the Bronx and Jerome Ave was not that far from me.
Yeah.
Where just, you know, there are hubcaps everywhere. Yeah, no, keeping busy, Gina. You know how it is. It's like
keeping busy.
You can't just be a comedian. You can't just be an actor. You've got to be every single thing in front and behind that person that you are and
yeah.
To get stuff done.
It's extraordinary. Okay, so to that end, you are originally from Portsmouth, Virginia. Is that the deal? What's the deal? There's a few conflicting. You grew up in the Bronx, though.
Yeah.
All right, but what's the deal?
All right, so I was born in Portsmouth, Virginia, because my father was in the Navy at the time. And my mother was living there, obviously, with him. They were married. And she, after I was born, she was just really bored. You know, she's from the South Bronx where like gunshots and salsa music puts you to sleep. She's like, this place is boring. It's too quiet. I'm lonely. I'm going back to the Bronx. You know, you finish up the Navy thing and you meet me back in the Bronx. So I was born a month later. We're back in the South Bronx. And
back to the, you know, back to that insanity. But that's, you know, which I mean, clearly, when I have people on the show, they always talk about in the various ways their childhood informed how they became stand-ups. So, and I always say these words, paint a picture, because there really is no way, other way of saying it. Paint a picture of life in the Bronx growing up. And I know you started stand-up at 16. We'll get to that. But I really want to know, what's your childhood like for Victor Cruz? How many in your family? Is it like, it's a Puerto Rican family. Is everybody
family.
Puerto Rican? Dad's Puerto Rican?
Yeah, both parents Puerto Rican.
Okay. Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico, the shining star. I have a brother and a sister.
Okay.
I also have a half-sister. She might be listening to the show as we speak.
Hello, half-sister. Give it up for the half-sister.
But you can only give like half an applause now.
One hand. You can't even hear it. It's happening.
We're actually applauding for you.
She can't even see it. Oh, my God.
So what is the South Bronx like? What is painting a picture? This is the crack era in the South Bronx, you know, in broad daylight.
Right, the 80s we're talking about?
Talking about the 80s, okay. You know, growing up in the 80s. And, you know, where a guy comes out with a bunch of samples, throws them in the air in broad daylight, everybody jumping down onto the ground to grab stuff like a piñata just broke open.
Sure.
And it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon and you're walking home from school. No cops in sight because they're afraid for their lives. But that's the negative side of it, right? The cool side about it is that, you know, music is great. There's break dancing going on right down the street. Hip hop is becoming what it's becoming. Obviously, in the 90s, it became a multi-billion dollar thing. Pizza was good back then. Pizza was really good.
Pizza was good.
Pizza, the slices were like humongous. And it was like 50 cents for a damn slice.
Yeah.
There's so many things that I could paint. That's what I see right now.
And I'm sure because, you know, just reading up on you, you know, the whole Latin American culture, you know, the families, the food, growing up with that community. Mm-hmm. So I think on the one hand, and I grew up on the Upper West Side, not, you know, far Upper West, like Jew Upper West. I was on Jew Upper West, Lincoln Center area, because I had it like that. Well, but I had my troubles.
Yeah, but Puerto Ricans were not too far from you guys.
Yeah, you were not too far.
We were in Hell's Kitchen at one point, you
right.
know.
Yeah.
We were doing our thing, you know, Lower East Side, Uptown. We weren't too far.
No, we definitely share, you know, certainly that.
And Jews and Puerto Ricans are very similar in the sense, you know, we worry about certain things to the max. I find similarities in the Jewish culture and Puerto Rican culture.
Yeah, I won't argue that. So you have this the community and then the drugs, just like, you know, I did. And
yeah,
I'm a few years older than you. I'm not gonna.
I don't think you're that much older than me. Yeah,
we look good. It's we a comedy. Comedy keeps
matters.
You young.
It does.
It
actually.
Really does. I mean, I don't feel any different than I did. I really, other than just having accumulated experience.
Uh-huh.
You know, through the, you know, you would hope, I mean, but I really, same mental.
You seem the same to me since, like, I first met you. I'll be honest with you. I mean, I always thought that you were always fabulous,
Thank
you know,
you.
Probably one of the prettiest comedians in the club, you know. And
Thank
she,
you.
And when I met Gina, she was not only doing comedy, but she was also managing at the time.
Right.
And, yeah, and Gina, you're the same to me. I mean,
Thank you.
The energy is
well,
the same.
Thank you. So I want to talk about how we met. I want to get just a little bit more so that you've got this, you know, going on, and do you discover in growing up in that situation that to deflect whatever might be going on? Like I used to do that with, you know, I was always fairly tall, but I used to, you know, and there were people that I went to school with that were prettier than me, or let's say, and I used to. I was the funny one to just, you know, if I can make you laugh, then I'm not going to get beat up.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of, you know, and even though like it's the Upper West Side, people still wanted to beat me up for my lunch money, you know,
if they could reach you.
Yeah, I was. Yeah. But I mean, I'm far more intimidating now, I think. But not then. So did you use humor in that way? Or did you were just you didn't have a lot of that? Or I mean, is your brother older, younger?
My brother's younger.
Okay.
I think for me.
Are you the eldest?
I'm the oldest. Yeah.
Okay, so you're looking out for everybody else.
I'm looking out for everybody else. And I think for me, you know, in my neighborhood growing up then, it was like, you know, we snapped on each other. And a lot of comedians kind of share, some comedians share the story where it's like comedy was like a defense mechanism for sure. And if you had the best jokes, you were cool and you were all right.
Right.
You know, but if you had the corny ass jokes, you better get out because they're coming to get you.
Yeah.
And then at some point, it changed for me. It went from defending myself to I didn't like seeing people having a bad day. So I'd always crack jokes to make them laugh. And if they had a good day, then I felt better.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's there. And there you find sort of, I guess, you know, your style or however that forms for you. And then I was looking up about things about you. And I guess you bumped into some ticket seller and that... Is that what happened? Somebody hawking comedy? You're a teenager and somebody's hawking comedy. How'd that go down?
I'm 16 years old. I had a really bad thing that happened in my family the night before this happened. It was terrible. Big fight. Just violent. Cops involved. The next day, I was like, I need a break.
Like a domestic?
Domestic situation. Just not good.
Okay.
And so here I am walking down with my buddy Mauricio, walking down in the village, walking down 3rd Street between Thompson and Sullivan.
Okay.
And you know what club I'm walking by.
Yeah.
This is the Boston Comedy Club. It used to be the Boston.
Yeah.
this guy is like, he's like, "Hey, buddy, hey, how are you? You want these tickets?" And he's trying to sell me these tickets. And I'm like, "I don't want no damn tickets." And so I'm just like, you know, give him that, like, brush them off like New Yorkers do. Walked to the corner, stopped, and thought to myself, I was like, I heard a voice. And it was like, you know, I always wanted to do comedy. Maybe I should go back and ask them if they have some kind of amateur night. I go back, and the guy's like, "Yeah, we do, we do. Here's my card." Gives me his card. I look at the name. It says David J. Nash. And I was like, "Oh, okay." He said, "Call me whenever. I'll set you up." It took me like 4 days to call him because I was terrified to set this thing up.
Right. You're like, "What did I just do?"
I don't know what I did. Right. I had no idea. I was right. So freaking nervous. You know, like when sure. I called the guy, I was sweating, dude. I was just like, "Oh my God, what am I doing?" He sets it up. He's like, "All right, well, a month from now, you're going to be doing comedy." And I was like, okay. Yeah. See you then.
Yeah. Now, to describe David J is kind of like a David Schwimmer-esque type of character. He's got that kind of look. He's the nicest guy ever. And it's amazing how we are, you know, when we're first starting out, like how nervous we get about, you know, any of this stuff. I don't know. Do you, do you get nervous today even with things? Or you're a little, you know, because you've put in so much work, that's gone a little bit?
You know, I think what happens now is that I'm in a place now where I'm trying to do a certain type of comedy that I want to do, that it's not like, of course, in the end, we have to make people laugh. But before, I felt like I was trying to make the people laugh. Like if I make them laugh, if I'm the cool kid, then everything is fine. Now I'm diving into what I really want to talk about. And so now it becomes the nervousness, not about the audience, but like, what am I going to say tonight? And how am I going to say it if I have a new joke? How do I get there? I have no idea.
Right.
But I now my thing is like, I just have to trust. I just have to trust. All these years, you got the craft, you got the skills, you know how to do this. So I have to trust now. And that becomes the scary part some days.
Yes, you know? I agree with that. And I'm in this game quite a long time. And I think even now, for me as a stand-up, it's never been about performance. And you went to SUNY Purchase.
Yeah.
So you have a real acting background. It's like not an easy school to get into for, you know, I auditioned. I did not get in. I went to NYU.
Who didn't accept you?
I don't know.
Tell me their name. I'll break their legs.
Please do. I could have gone to SUNY Purchase. I didn't get in. I didn't get into Juilliard. That was a crazy. But I did go
to
NYU.
Anybody gets into Juilliard. I think they lie about it. Like I went.
Kate Rigg got into Juilliard.
I don't believe her.
My friend Chris Grosset got into Juilliard.
Liar.
I could be. a couple people got in there. A couple people did. All right, so you go to SUNY Purchase, and we'll get to that too. I'm like amazed because I have to go back. When I met you at officially again, maybe I don't know so much at Boston, but definitely at New York Comedy Club. When I met you, first of all, Victor is you're professional and polite, and you were not up in my face, and that's, you know, one of these things when you're a manager of a club is how often people approach you, and you were not like that ever. Always and super funny and always, you know, on these all these different people's shows at New York. I mean, whose shows were you doing regularly over at New York Comedy Club?
I think I started with like Ozzy and Seymour's show. Okay. Ozzy and Seymour's show. Yeah, I did their shows regularly in the beginning. And then I was invited to do other shows. I don't remember. And then you would put me on shows from time to time.
From time to time.
You would call me and say, "Hey, you want to do this day?" And I'd say, "Sure." And then it was me and I think another comedian. Sometimes you had these, there were some really good primetime shows you had. And me and this other buddy of mine, we'd always be like, "Well, who you pick today to do the guest spot?" Or,
right,
you know?
Right, right. And then there was Latino Laughter there too, yeah, right? Yeah, yeah. So then you had those shows too.
Which Ozzy had for years. And after he passed away, George Diaz took it over. And I know George and Ozzy used to do the show years ago. And they always worked on it. And it's still around, Latino Laughter.
And amazing. Again, with the community, the the Latin, the Latino community. Mm-hmm. This is the thing, you know, like if I call my Jew friends and say, come see my show, they're like, eh, you have so many shows, you know? I don't know why I have to stereotype my Jews. Eh, like they, no one talks this way. Eh, you have so many shows.
Show
has,
already. Why
she's
come
got
now?
So many shows. I'll see you when I, how much do I have to pay? Is it comp? Are you comping?
Who do I got to talk to get comp?
Right. It's like, are we sitting up front and then they're never on time? Yeah.
See, I told you. I told you the similarities of Puerto Ricans. Right. Yeah, there you go.
Well, that being said, the Latinos come out and support, though. They really do. I'm not saying the Jews don't. I'm not doing that. Not doing it. Just saying, my friend.
For some reason, you can't access your show tomorrow. The station's not working.
Exactly.
I knew a Jew owned that radio station.
I love talking about the Jews. You know, you could always talk about what you are. You know, this is when you start venturing out. What is Boricua? What does that really mean? What does that really mean? What does it mean to be Boricua?
Well, Boricua stems from Borinquen. Borinquen is the original name for what's known today as Puerto Rico. Borinquen, that was the name that was given when the Taino Indians, lived on the island. A lot of people say Tainos don't exist anymore after the Spanish came in and kind of wiped out a huge number of them. But other people have other belief systems that there's a huge community still of Taino Indians, just like the Native Americans. Like we still see group, you know, there are people.
So rather
that live
than
here.
Saying Puerto Rican,
well, yeah,
you can say Taino. If you wanted to,
I mean,
take
you
it
could say Boricua.
Far.
Boricua is the original. You know, you would refer to somebody from El Borinquen, which is not Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is the name given to the island by the Spanish. When they came and, you know, they saw all these riches, rich port,
yes.
Puerto Rico, that's what it means.
Yes, yes.
So, yeah, I mean, it's really up to the person. You know, you can't tell, you know, people are like, no, yo soy Puerto Riqueño, I'm Boricua. I mean, it's whatever you want to, you know.
Boricua!
Whatever you want to be.
I just want to say it. What's up with that Puerto Rican Day Parade? Okay, I don't know. So amazing.
And that's a parade that everybody comes.
Oh,
you know, that day is the day that you're Puerto Rican. You're just you get in that parade and you're Puerto Rican. You know, you don't got to worry about, you know, do I fit in?
That's
coming
up, isn't it? When is that?
In June.
Yeah, that's it's coming.
First week.
I got to prepare now is all I'm saying. What I'm going to do, what transportation I'm going to take. Prepare
that's
now,
right.
Ladies
you're,
and gentlemen.
You're like blocks away from where it ends.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a whole thing over here. It's
so you
great,
get,
though.
You get the aftermath.
I get the aftermath. I always walk through it. I'm like, please, someone touch me.
Throw water on
right.
me.
Throw water on me. Give me some food. It always smells so good. People are so festive and happy. All right. Let's get back to you and
cool,
your comedy.
Cool.
But I like to digress like that. All right. So you're doing comedy at New York. What mm-hmm. happens? But let's go back to Boston Comedy Club when you do your first new town. Because you are really a perfect example. We have mm-hmm. a lot of new stand-ups and people that are aspiring, listening.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
You were somebody like really grassroots mm-hmm. brought this thing to life for yourself. Like,
yeah.
I mean, all the businesses, all you really, this is like, this is hustle and grind. To mm-hmm. get, you know, to do this. So what happens at Boston Comedy Club and that first time and the career that follows after?
Well, first time, first night, my mother is there with me. My best friend Sean comes with his mother. I'm 16, you know, so I got to come with my mother. They still smoked in the clubs back then. You know, you didn't really have to buy a pack of cigarettes. You just had to sit in the club and just take it all in and you had your fix. So there was a few of us, you know, you had to bring like four people. I can't remember who the fourth person was. They'll probably kill me when they
hear
this.
They're coming.
They're like, I was there from the beginning, you know? So I tell you what.
It's a half sister.
My half sister's coming. I can't hear her applauding because she's only allowed to clap with one hand. No.
Yeah.
You know, so David J was hosting that night. For some folks, they probably know him as DJ Nash because he doesn't really go by David J now. DJ Nash. But he gave me the best introduction that any host, you doing it for the first time, could ever give you. Like, he almost like stopped the show to say, this next guy coming up, you know, he's only 16 years old. You know, whatever happens on the stage, I want you guys to give him all the love in the world because this is his first time. I mean, he set the stage. So the moment I came on, I wasn't even afraid if the audience would like me or not. I was just so excited. And that introduction really helped to warm up the situation. I mean, not every comedian gets that, especially on their first time, you know? And the show went really, really well for that first time.
And you caught the bug.
I caught the bug. I immediately signed up for another one. Came for the second show. Now I was feeling a little cocky. Mm-hmm. I was feeling a little cocky, you know? I showed up and I had some shades on my head. That's like douchebag thing to do.
Yeah, that's so douchey, Victor.
It's douchey. You put your shades on your head. You know, I showed up and I'm like, you know, I'm feeling myself. I had this really cool jacket with the stripes and stuff. And I was talking all this stuff. And I was even throwing some curse words in there. I'm like, yeah, my mom's in the audience. I don't care. So that show went really well. Then came the third and fourth show. Totally bombed.
Mm.
Bad.
Yeah.
I didn't come prepared. I had ideas, things that I wanted to talk about, but there were no setups. There were no premises. There were no punches, just ideas, you know?
Sure.
Nothing developed. Totally bombed. On the fourth time, I said, I'm never going to do comedy again. This is not for me. I quit. That was it. That was the end of my comedy career after the fourth show.
Okay,
what happens next?
What happens, Al Pacino? What pulls you back in?
8 months.
Just when you were out.
8 months later, I heard about some audition that they were doing at the Comic Strip Live. I don't know why I thought, I'm going to go to that thing. And I'm online. Believe it or not, Steve Aarons, New York Comedy
yes.
Club, Steve Aarons, Rumpemeyer for some folks who
yeah.
knew him back in the day.
Yeah.
He is literally hustling the line. You know, he's hustling the line. He's getting new talent from the line. He's like, listen, I'm calling. Okay, here's my number.
That's good.
And so, so I called him, and he set me up with a bringer show at New York Comedy Club. And I did that, and the show was really, really good.
Were you more prepared? Did you know now that this was going to take more than personality to, you know,
yeah,
I think
I knew that I had to come with something.
Okay.
I had to come somewhat prepared, and I did, and I felt it, and I said, okay, this is how I'll approach it every time. And then after that, it was, I never quit again. I may have taken a break, but I didn't quit.
Okay, know? So clearly, this is all before you go to SUNY Purchase.
This is all before I go to SUNY Purchase.
And then you get the training and background there. To really be, I would think, an actor,
yeah.
right? To really, and I don't know if that, and your writing, your skill set becomes that much greater because you're getting this, you know, you're learning, you know,
sure.
in this school. And then when you come, and I assume productions were done there and you did things.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And so when you came back and you started stand-up again, did you, and maybe you never stop, you're doing stand-up the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
When do you feel that, you know, you're making some serious strides in this? When does the first taste come of something like big?
Well, I think what was happening without me realizing it was that my act outs were becoming more alive. They had a lot more detail because of the acting. Like, now I was really becoming these characters on stage. I sort of did it before, but I think now I was more conscious of it, like my stage presence and how I wanted to become these characters. And so that was cool. That started to build. And I did a lot of stand-up during the summer times in between.
Okay.
I did some shows throughout the year. I did some shows up at the school, but it was during the summers that I would come and really hit the stage again. So I think for me, when things got really serious is probably when I got out of school. The day before I graduated, I booked a role on The Sopranos, and that was a big deal, and I said, oh, man, it's taking off.
The day before you graduated.
I got
on,
the gig
man.
On The Sopranos. I swear to God, it's like a movie.
That is like a movie. Like,
yeah.
Did you call home, like, can you believe, or were you, like.
I told everybody.
I mean, that's insane.
I told everybody. Matter of fact, I was so excited. I told David J. about it. David J. wanted to kill me. No, he actually, believe it or not, paid for the postcards so that I could send it out to casting directors, managers, agents to let everybody know that I was going to be on The Sopranos. Like,
wow.
He said, I'm going to pay for this because I want you to put yourself out there. It was so kind of him to do that, you know, because I wasn't, at that time, you don't know how you should promote yourself.
Right.
And so, yeah, did that and then. And there was like 8 months of complete silence.
You know, this business. You know, a side note to David J. David Jay, when he was leaving Boston Comedy Club, where, you know, obviously I managed, decided he was going to make, you know, go to California with mm-hmm. his wife. And I don't know if he's still,
he's still married.
So he went to California and he said, I have this really great guy that is going to run the new talent shows at Boston. Why don't you take a look at him? And that guy happens to be Ed Helms. Ed Helms ran. I remember watching Ed and thinking, oh, this guy's going to be fine for New Talent Night. Only making multi-millions of dollars
oh,
now. But,
my
but
God.
You know, it's funny. We never, this is the thing with this. You never yeah. know. And, you know, what's going to happen. So, you've created these characters and you've created these, all these different avenues for yourself. Mm-hmm. So what came first? What in the Victor Cruz line of clothing was it? What the hell? What was it? What came first, Victor? I mean, it was comedy. When did you, what was it? Is it Victor Cruz Inc.? Enter Experience Enterprise? Is it Victor Cruz Starship? What is happening? What the fuck?
So what was first for me was that, you know, it's funny. I was auditioning like crazy, but I wasn't really booking a lot of stuff at first. I think I did a couple of commercials, a couple of episodes of Law and Order, but it was like quiet most of the time. And so I started going through this, I guess, stage in your life where you start to question, you know, you're sitting at the window and you're looking like, well, should I do something else?
It's always at the window.
It's
isn't
always
it?
At the window. It's so
there.
Stereotypical,
it's
but it's at the window
you're
and
looking
there's
out.
and there's a fucking star. Can I curse? Is that okay?
Yeah, totally.
And there's a fucking star out that window looking back at you
right.
and smiling or something. So then a buddy of mine was like, dude, you know, you do all these characters, you know, instead of like feeling down about anything, and this is my one of my brothers who's now working, but he's been working for years now, but he's on that show iZombie on the CW. And so he told me, he said, dude, you should write some characters. Or he said, you know this guy named, there's a guy named Tyler Perry that's going to come out soon with his first movie called Diary of a Mad Black Woman. He already had his plays going, but this was the first time he was going to do his feature that was going to be out in the world. And he said, this dude is about to be major.
Right.
He's like, I think you're more talented. You know, at the time, I didn't know who he was.
right,
I mean, I didn't
right.
know anything
but
about
still,
him. No. But that's my friend. He was just like, you're more talented. You know, you can do this. You can do what he's doing your own way. And I said, cool. So I wrote a sketch, a spoof on Law and Order. And I was just like, this show is so ridiculous. Like, you know, evidence falls from the sky and the show ends in 45 minutes and it's fast and it's quick.
Right.
You know, so I was like, I'll write something outrageous. I wrote this sketch called Flaw in Order. I presented it to my friend. I remember he was the one that was pushing me to do it. And then it took him forever to read the freaking script. So I cornered him somewhere and I said, dude, I'm going to read every single character in this damn script and you're going to hear this thing. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay. And then he was like, all right, well, we'll shoot it. I said, cool. You know, because he and another buddy of ours, Lyndon, they had the experience, which I think you met Lyndon in the process. I was always with somebody else when pushing those DVDs, we'll get to.
Yeah.
So we end up shooting this sketch, and I remember my buddy Lyndon, he didn't agree with, I think, the premise of it. He thought some of it was unrealistic. And my buddy Mac was like, listen, if we don't shoot this, Vic will never know what he can do. You know, he'll never be given the opportunity to see something come to life. Let him learn through the process. So we shot the thing for like $20 and some Chinese food. You know, another buddy of mine that was in our circle, he made a short film that I think cost him like $60,000 or something. We're all submitting these shorts into festivals. And we feel terrible because no one's giving him any love.
The guy that with the $60,000.
Yeah, but they're giving our $20 budget Flaw in Order short.
How many minutes was your Flaw in Order?
It was, let's see, it was maybe 9 minutes?
Eight minutes,
something like that.
And you submitted it where?
The first place we submitted to was the Urban World Film Festival.
Okay.
And they took it. They were sponsored by MTV and it was exciting.
That's a huge thing.
I've never been part of a festival
before. The film community, even on whatever level you're making, you're creating, and here it is, Flaw in Order. What happens?
So
it wins. Does it win?
Well, it doesn't win any awards, but it creates this relationship with Urban World.
Okay.
And Stacey Spikes, who now Urban World is about to go into their 20-year anniversary this year. And I begin to create a relationship with this group and Stacey Spikes. And because of Law and Order, because of the relationships, they bring me in to produce funny commercials, campaigns for their festival. And, you know, they're just connecting me and I'm building relationships with other filmmakers and things.
That's great.
So anyways, Flaw in Order then launches the idea that I could create my own sketch comedy show on DVD. And the idea was that we would push it in these streets like Wu-Tang Clan did back in the day out the trunk of their car,
right.
You know.
Make it rain.
Make it rain.
Sketch
make,
you comedy. Know? Make it rain sketch comedy.
No, you got all these rappers in Times Square selling, you know, rap music.
Right.
It's like, why don't we approach it the same way? Nobody's doing this. No one's pushing a sketch comedy show on a DVD. It's different. So why not?
Sure.
So that launched the Victor Cruz show, Volume 1. Who is Victor Cruz? Ask me if there's a Volume 2.
Is there a Volume 2?
Coming soon. I don't know when.
Well, there's so many other things. I mean, there's just so many other
things.
Yeah,
yeah.
So Volume 2's in the works.
Yeah, yeah.
There's, you know, when it comes to funding, because mm-hmm. I want to ask this question
just
for my own.
Mm-hmm.
You have reached out, I mean, for anybody that's aspiring, you've reached out like the internet way through, you know,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if they're GoFundMes or what, Kickstarters or whatever you're doing.
Yeah, Kickstarter, there's, what is Indiegogo.
Right, so, and these things all really helped get your projects off the ground.
Big time.
Okay.
Big time.
Just want to say that for those, you know, because even for myself, you know, you have to create these avenues for yourself. If you believe in yourself and people are, all you have to do is set up the campaign
mm-hmm.
and if it comes, then make it happen.
Sure.
You know, so you did all that. I want to talk a little bit about the comedy and the scene and alcohol and drugs. I like to touch on those things
sure.
too. Did this escape you? Did you ever fall victim to any of that debauchery or, you know, growing up, maybe in your household, discipline and religion kept you out of that? Give me a little synopsis of were there any vices that Victor Cruz had to say, holy smoke, I got to get away from that?
That's a good question because I think for me, in the beginning, I started having a drink here and there to feel comfortable, probably like a lot of comics might do that, give them a little liquid courage. And then it just went a little too far. Like it was like too much drinking to the point, I don't want to say that I was an alcoholic because I wouldn't say that I got up in the morning and needed to drink or desired it. But I knew when it came to comedy, I'd have to drink something in order to do comedy comfortably and to be free and be myself, or what at least I thought was being myself. So yeah, like I would get so drunk sometimes I'd be on stage and it's like the punches weren't even coming. The premises were scattered. The jokes were all over the place and I didn't care. And I would laugh at the jokes as I understood them, hearing them back
right.
in my mind.
Yeah, they're always great there. Yeah.
But it's good that you say that because now approaching comedy recently, I really don't drink at all now. I don't drink at all.
Yeah.
For me, I say socially, but... Maybe. And so now when I do comedy, I'm conscious that I don't drink at all because now it's like I'm going to deal with myself and I'm going to go on stage. And now you had asked earlier about the scary thing. Are you afraid? And now I do get fearful because I don't know myself as I used to without the alcohol.
Well, that brings me to another point because I was looking at your Facebook page, and you were talking about your car chronicles.
So oh,
anybody
yeah.
that, you know, will go on to Victor Cruz's Facebook page or Twitter, but he talks from his car. But you were talking about fear-based choices.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're all in this world making choices. And
mm-hmm.
one of the things that, you know, any positive guru, we'll
mm-hmm.
get to that too,
yeah, sure.
might say is, you know, we got to work through those things. You know, every day, every single day, and every morning, I have to really dust off the cobwebs of, I used to do a blog. I don't really do it now because my father found my blog and he's like, why do you sound so miserable? it's a creative expression, Dad. Why do you have to tell people you don't do well in the mornings? They should know that your father's doing well. He's doing well. He's doing great. My dad's great. But he found my blog. So anyway, my point is, it's hard. It's so crazy. So I don't blog, at least on the internet right now.
Yeah.
You know, but that's my fear, my dad. See, that's my fear. It's like, my fear is I don't want him to see what I'm writing about. Why should that stop me?
Sure.
We're talking about fears on stage and liquid courage and all that. So you're going now, and are you, you know, full on balls to the wall? Are you balls to the wall, Victor?
I'm just whipping my balls out.
Are you whipping
your
balls?
Comedy.
Oh my god!
As you eat these grapes,
I know. I'm eating grapes, we're drinking coffee.
By the way, there is a little Asian kid on my coffee cup. You know, and he's so cute.
Isn't he?
Who is he?
All right, so that's an interesting story because. Yeah, I am drinking, well, you're drinking coffee out of a mug. That is Nicolas Cage's son. Why? Now,
what?
Why do I have a mug that says, Happy Birthday, Daddy, with Nicolas Cage's son's face on it?
He looks nothing like Nicolas Cage.
No, I see it in the smile. Don't you see a little? I mean, he's a sort of adorable.
Yeah, maybe
that
is the smile from Face
Off. But that's Nick's kid, and he'd even be surprised. But anyway, it was
he doesn't know
left
that this
abandoned
is a son.
In an apartment that my friend happened to, you know, it's a work related situation. But she was like, "Do you want a mug with Nicolas Cage's son on it?" And I said, "Yes. I would like that very much."
Can I tell you, I did a movie with Nicolas Cage.
Did you?
I did The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Oh, yeah.
I had a small role in that. And they brought in Nicolas Cage. They always introduce you to the actor. And they were like, Nicolas Cage, this is Victor Cruz, Nicolas Cage. And he goes in to shake my hand. He's like, hey, I'm Nicolas Cage. I'm like, no shit. I know this. I know you're Nicolas Cage. You didn't have to say it. He said it, and then you said it. It was the funniest thing. But he was so like, I'm Nicolas Cage, just in case you didn't know.
It's a good Nick Cage. Look at how I'm calling him Nick, like I know him. It's a good Nick Cage.
It's a good Nicky,
hey,
you
Nick.
Know?
I'm going to call him up. Hey, Nick, the kid cup is getting a lot of attention.
This kid cup is trending.
Kid cup's doing well.
It's trending. Hashtag Nick's son.
Nick's son. Hashtag Nick's son. You know, I like, something on Facebook popped up where these random celebrities sort of, you know, when you take a picture and I can't think of the, when someone pops up behind.
Oh, like they photobomb?
Photobomb.
I couldn't think of.
Listen, this is how old I'm getting. When they photobomb.
You know, when the kids...
Jim, when they photobomb, Jim.
When the kids, they jump in and you do silly things behind.
When the kids photobomb. There's one really great one with Nick Cage. And he's just smiling in the back. Like he's just always there. All right, so yes.
But Nick seems to be fearless. We were talking about fears.
Yes, thank you for that. God, getting us back on track.
You could tell I used to host the show now.
I love it. So yes, so to that end, you have a guru.
I do have a guru.
What's that all about?
Guru Enlightenment, I met her in 2007. Now, a friend of mine recommended her. I had just lost my dad.
I'm sorry.
And he suffered a lot, so he finally got a chance to rest and transition over to the next phase, you know?
He's watching now.
He's here, probably.
I hope so.
Can we get him a chair?
Have some grapes.
Okay. He likes grapes.
Good.
So my friend, I talked to a friend of mine, and she said, you know what, I'm going to introduce you to my spiritual teacher. And immediately, you know, I'm Puerto Rican, immediately I thought, oh man, I hope this is not like some brujeria thing or some witchcraft shit. I don't know. I was like, yeah, sure. And so she's like, okay, you got it. I'm going to introduce you to her. And so I think like 2 or 3 months later, Guru was having a workshop at... Uptown in Washington Heights, and I came to the workshop. There was nothing but women in the room, and I said, what kind of meeting is this? Is this one of those like women hate men meetings? Am I gonna get beat up here? I don't know what's happening. But I might like it because that was a lot of pretty girls.
Sure.
And I saw a buddy of mine that was there. I was like, oh, okay, Mike, how you doing? So he said hi. Nicolas Cage is there too. Hey, I'm Nicolas Cage.
No. Now his 14-year-old kid is there now because that cup is 100 years old. But yeah,
so I get there and so she's talking about all these things. She gives out like these pamphlets, and it's like a pamphlet of some sort. And it's like the different lessons that she's going to teach at this workshop. And a lot of them were like basic things like, you know, love yourself, pay your bills, take care of your body, you know, basic things that, you know, I'm just thinking to myself, well, we kind of know these things. I mean, this is kind of basic, you know. And the more she spoke, I said to myself, you know, they are the basic things, but these are things we don't do. We really don't do. We know them, but do we really do these things? So immediately I started connecting with her a little bit more, and I said, okay. Then I had to leave because I had to do a show that night. I think I was doing a show for you that night, matter of fact. I was definitely going to New York Comedy Club that night. And I told her, I said, look, I can't stay. I got this show. But then she said, don't worry about it. You know, we'll see each other soon. I feel like I know you. She gave me the super hug. It was the best hug I'd ever gotten my entire life. And I said, oh, my God, I got to see this woman. The hug and the meeting was great. So I finally met up with her. I don't think I still know what it is that she does. So I came to meet her one day and she says, okay, why don't you tell me about yourself? And I was trying to be funny. I was like, I'm Victor Cruz. She's like, well, that's a good start. You know?
Like Nick Cage. Don't
Nicholas
you know?
Cage. I'm Victor Cruz.
She's like, I already know.
But I already know, but continue. How would I not know that you're Victor? Okay. Yeah. So, and this is, of course, before the football player. But we'll get to that in a second. So I start rambling. I start telling about myself and up until about the age of 10. And she says, okay, stop. She said, look, this is who you are. Then she starts to tell me who I am. She gives me a whole list of these things of who I am. And she says, these are the past lifetimes that you lived. And if you're anybody, you probably think it sounds crazy. But when she said it to me, I started to cry. And I didn't know why I was crying. I was just like, what's going on with me, you know? It was like I had released all of this stress I had been, bricks that I've been carrying for years. And then all of a sudden I was open, like, oh my God, I want to talk to you about this. She said, okay, we're going to stop here. She said, look, here's my card. Call me in 3 days. All right. Cause this is how I do it. I usually spend 16 months with a student. We work on all these different things about themselves. And by the 16 months, you're on your own, you're doing your thing. You know, the question is like, well, how much do you charge? She goes, well, I don't charge anything. I said, you don't charge anything. That's weird, you know,
right? You
would think most people charge for this kind of thing. She's like, no. She said, this is my journey. This is what my purpose, what I was meant to do. And so, no, you call me in 3 days if you want to do this. I was like, I want to do this. She said, no. 3 days from now, you call me. Called the 3 days from then. And I was clear that I wanted to. Basically, the idea was that I knew what I knew up until this point, but I didn't really know who I was or really what my journey, my purpose was going to be.
And how long ago was this with her?
2007.
Okay, so this is now 9 years of a journey with someone.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And a lot has happened.
A lot of great things have happened, you know? And it's like she always says, you know, she goes, honestly, I don't do anything for you. I show you what the options are. And you guys are the ones that have to do the hard work. You have to get up and you have to open those doors and face those fears and deal with the negativity. And you're the one that has to take the risk. You got to try, you know? So she's encouraged me over the years. And if I were to tell you that I haven't changed since then, that would be a complete lie. So much has happened in my life that when I look back, I mean, even the decisions not to drink, to do stand-up, that came from me. And it's funny because she told me, she says, one day you're going to be able to do stand-up without having a drink.
Well, you know, having watched your evolution over the years and your progress, you know, it's certainly no small factor that this person has definitely informed you. Right. Mm-hmm. Informed you, and the work, it speaks for itself. And so let's talk about the stock room.
Sure.
That's the baby on deck right now.
Yeah.
And why don't you give us a history? And I know that's it's going to, you have, I can't even think of the word, but April 24th is when you're going to launch it.
Yeah.
Out of the gate.
So the stock room was a movie that I wanted to write back in 1998, believe it or not. I had worked in a stock room at a clothing store, and I loved the people that I worked with. We had so much fun that I drew a picture of these two guys, and I called it the stock room guys. I put it on my wall and I said to myself, this will be the first feature film that I ever make. I put it on my wall at some point. I ended up going to school. It was somewhere in the back of my mind. I kind of forgot about it, but I always sort of thought about it from time to time. And then moving forward, way forward, I think in 2012, I decided to move to California. I was going to go to Los Angeles. My wife and I were going to make the big move to sort of take my career to the next phase. And she was so gracious to, you know, want to go with me. And I think she needed a change too. So went out to LA. She stayed behind so I could set up shop out there. And then I was going to come get her. And then 2 weeks later, we discovered we were expecting a baby. So we decided not to go to LA and move there because all our family's here.
Right.
You know,
we need all the help you can get.
We need all the help you can get, you know.
Exactly.
Both the grandmas are here and, you know, you know the rest of the story.
Yes, yes.
So while I was there, I started writing with my best buddy, Malcolm Goodwin, who was the one that encouraged me that time to do Flaw and Order.
Okay.
I'm staying at his place in LA, and his wife and Malcolm's sister-in-law, we're all sitting at the table, and we started kind of like a little writer's group, three of us, and we're just kind of like sharing ideas. And as I was writing one day, the stock room pops back up into my mind, into my world. And it was almost like the characters were like, hey, remember us? You want to write us? And I was like, oh, okay. And so I thought that it would be a TV show. I started developing this TV show idea. And then all of a sudden, I shared it with my buddy Malcolm's sister-in-law. And she said, you know, this is great. She said, but it feels like a really good indie, you know, really good indie film. And I said, you know, it was always supposed to be a film because that's what I originally wanted. So I was really inspired by that and revisited what I originally wanted to do. And I started writing the screenplay. Within 4 weeks, I had a first draft of The Stockroom. I think a couple of months later, we did our first reading in New York. We did a reading in L.A. We did a series of readings. And I was ready to shoot this thing by the end of 2013. We couldn't raise the money we needed by the end of 2013. So we waited a year and, we were able to put together some monies between raising through Indiegogo.com,
right,
which you mentioned
Amazing,
earlier.
Right? Yep.
We raised, I think, close to $10,000 through Indiegogo, through friends and family. My wife came on board as an investor. My friends of mine that I've known for years came on board as investors. And I think at the end with actual cash, I don't know if you want to share with you like how much we spent.
Yeah,
making
I think it.
It
helps. I think it helps.
I think for
yeah.
the listeners, you know,
yeah.
I think with actual cash outside of in-kind sponsorship, we probably spent between $60,000 and $70,000 to make the movie.
And that is a very reasonable amount of money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know,
that's
it
not
really
something.
Is,
that's
right.
not you know that's money. You know, that's money for the Hollywood system. Maybe it's like it's a joke, you know, but for me, it's like no, this is serious money.
Yeah, and for new people, for people that want to do films and stuff, I mean, there's all these permits and things that you have to, the process of that, was that tiresome? Were you excited? I mean, was it, you know, just grueling, all those things, or all those things combined?
I think when you want to do something and you've decided that you're going to do it pretty much by any means necessary, and I mean that in the most positive way, not like, you know, hurting or robbing anybody to make your movie. But I just think that you'll see the challenges, but you won't be afraid to deal with them. You know, you're going to be making phone calls that you've never made before. You'd have to talk to people you never talked to before. You have to step up to the plate, and you find that you discover that, wow, I could do that. I'm doing it. I spoke to that person with no problem. Wow, I just asked somebody for $7,000. I would never have done that before. Terrifying.
And that's because you believe in yourself. You believe in the
yes.
work that you're doing, and that is key, and that is central to anybody that wants to continue this way.
So important. That was key. What you just said. It was that belief in myself, belief in the project, because when you're excited about a project and you believe in yourself and in the project, you get other people excited, and other people will literally just want to be around you because the energy feels right. And they see in you something that they would love to do as well. So they want to join on and help you. You know, I've had so many people came on board that worked for free Works for free because they saw the vision. They said, Vic, we want to help you.
I'm working for free, Vic. Next one. I'm not even joking. I always offer.
You
yeah,
too.
Jim
awesome.
Byrne.
Oh, thank you so much, guys.
We're there.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I'll
bring the coffee and the Nick Cage mugs.
Will Nick Cage be there? Hey, guys, I'm Nick Cage.
If I could bring Nick Cage on board, come on.
He could bring any one of his fancy cars.
Exactly.
It's funny. He was on set that day talking about his cars. I was like, oh, my God. He's like, yeah, I got this other car. He was like,
oh. That's so weird.
I'm like, I got this Metro card in my pocket.
So back to the stock room. So tell us, because we don't have, the time is flying.
Okay.
We have about like 9 minutes,
okay.
I think, to talk about the, maybe a little bit more. But anyway, talk about the stock room and what was that, Jim? What did you just show me? Well, I have to, what, showing me time. How many minutes? 12 minutes. Yeah, say it out loud. It's okay.
We got 12 minutes.
We have 12 minutes.
One thing I do have to say is that Guru Enlightenment, who is my spiritual teacher, came on board as a director as well on this project. And we worked really, really well together because since I was directing, but I was also in it, I was also playing every producer you could imagine. On the movie, like, I was dealing with a lot of stuff. Like, one moment I was dealing with payroll, and then 2 minutes later I had to be on set to spew, you know, say lines that I hadn't even studied, but somehow I knew them. I remember my boy Rick, he was like, how do you know your lines? I said, I have no idea, but I guess I wrote it. It's in my system. I trust,
sure.
And it comes. But Guru, and this is important for me because, you know, I've worked with a lot of great directors and people have given me opportunities, but I thought that during this process, she really brought the best out of me in terms of as an actor. You know, I had an opportunity, someone who knew me so well, they knew exactly what to get out of me. And she did that for all the actors on set as well. The set was always extremely positive, laid back. It always felt good. There was never stress. I had more stress on a short film than I had on this picture, which we shot for 15 days, a tight 15 days, which normally you do at least 18 to 20, you know, on an indie or something.
Okay.
It was really cool, but I just have to give it so much love because when I watch the movie, I'm really, really proud of everything that we did.
Yeah,
and
I saw a little.
Involved.
I saw it looks great. I saw a little bit of the trailer. I think it's on your website.
Yeah,
and again, it's premiering. You're doing something at Gotham, but you did film. Plug Broadway. You filmed some of it at Broadway, which was cool.
I gotta give a lot of love to Al Martin. Al Martin hooked me up. And Gina, you were there when I shot it.
Yep.
You were there. Because I remember Steve Ahrens showed it.
He had to be there.
He had to be there super early in the morning to open up. And then he left around 2 in the afternoon. You came.
Yep.
So you guys were there. And Al was so supportive. You know, he said, Vic, do your thing. You know, you want to do that? All I ask is that I think I had to cover some expense, but it was nothing.
It was nothing. He's good like that.
I mean, he hooked me up, man. And I'm so grateful for you guys for just allowing me to be there. And that scene is great.
Yeah, it's so great that you're doing that. And so, again, it's April 24th you're doing it?
Yeah, so what we're doing, and just to clarify for some of the listeners,
yes.
April 24th, we're at the Gotham Comedy Club. Now, this is not a screening of the movie. What it is, it's a comedy show. It's going to feature me and a few other comedians from the film. And Angelo Lozada is also joining us on that bill,
great.
Which is great. J.I. Star from 97.9 La Mega is going to be providing us with music. And what's great about this show is that when you buy your ticket, the night of, you get a free copy of the film. So you walk away with a great souvenir and really, you know, blood, sweat, and tears and the love that went into this thing.
It's really great. And again, like, I think the Latino community, I mean, the coming out and supporting each other. And that's the other thing I wanted to touch on, you know, because in reading about you, it's not just, you know, this work. You do a lot of stuff for
mm-hmm.
your community. I mean, is part of what you do, is it integral to who you are to give back?
Yeah, I think it's important, you know, especially like we shot the entire film literally blocks away from here. We were on 115th Street for the majority of those days. And what we did was all the clothes that we used in the stockroom, we donated them back to a program in the community. What they do is they sell the clothing, but then they use that money for programming in East Harlem. And so there were so many things I wanted to do. And, you know, I have a lot of ideas. We couldn't do everything. But it's important for me to help. Like when people shoot movies in certain places around the world, sometimes they just shoot and they leave. And sometimes they leave a mess. I was just trying to be conscious of the neighborhood that I was in.
Yeah, I think that that's what I get from you. Mm-hmm. That's what I get from you in the work that you do and who you are as a person. Your brother also, he's in something now. What did I read? The Naked Truth?
Well, he's my spiritual brother. He's not my blood brother.
Okay, he's not your blood.
But he's doing a show called The Naked Truth that he's been touring around. We just did a show recently. Well, a few days ago, we did a show. And so what I do now is I open up for his show. I do comedy. I warm up the audience. I get them ready for the show. And it's an excellent show about, again, facing your fears and really dropping down all your guards, letting go of that ego and pride and seeing things for what they are.
Yeah, I think the thing that a lot of comics, you know, obviously we want to make people laugh and we want to, you know, exercise whatever demons or we have in ourselves, or we're just general. Like, look, there's so many things. Some people are just genuinely funny, and they, like, Kevin Hart doesn't have demons. Okay, that guy never had a fucking demon that I'm aware of. But like, some of us are like really, you know, it's like a therapy session. But I think for the most part, with what you do, there's that element of thought provoking. In your work and the work that you do and so on, it's very commendable.
Thank you.
So in addition to that, what else is coming up for you?
So let's see here. Yeah. So there's a film that I did called Crazy Famous last year, about four guys who break out of a mental institution to find the real Osama bin Laden.
The real one,
because the one they killed wasn't real. That comes out sometime this year. I don't know exactly when it is, but it's called Crazy Famous, and I'm one of the four guys that breaks out. And it was a lot of fun. And then, of course, after this show on April 24th, I'm going to be touring a series of shows throughout the country where it looks like I think the first or second week of July, I'm going to be in Los Angeles. I'm doing the same thing I'm doing here, where you buy your ticket, you get a copy of the movie.
Great.
I'll do a series of shows in New York, which you guys can hear about. You can log on to my website, victorcruzentertainment.com or victorcruzfilms.com, to simplify it for you guys, because that other thing is a little too long. Some people like Victor Cruz.
Victor Cruz, attorney at law. Victor Cruz. Victor Cruz, gynecologist to the stars. I used to do that with Ben Bailey. You know, Ben Bailey has this voice that, like, you know, Ben Bailey. And I'm Ben Bailey, gynecologist to the stars. It's like Ben Bailey, attorney at law. I don't know why I do that. I have, like, comedy Tourette's.
Yeah, yeah.
Where, like, I will just recite someone's punchline over and over all day long for no reason. Like, it's just, that's just me.
Well, it's like a song.
Yeah.
It's like a song. You like a song, you might sing it. And for us, we like, you know, saying jokes that we love.
Yeah. We just, yeah. So. Except when you're doing them at home alone, it's a little nuts. David Juskow, who's been on the show, he does that too. So I don't feel alone in that. But anyway, so people can find you on your website, which is, again,
You can log on to victorcruzfilms.com. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. It's all the same thing, which is Victor Cruz Films. So if you're on any of those three social media platforms, find me there. I update everybody on those platforms of what I'm doing. And yeah, and any of the shows, come on out. It's going to be April 24th again, Gotham Comedy Club. You should definitely buy your ticket in advance, because I know this show is definitely going to sell out. GothamComedyClub.com, and then just in the search box, look up The Stockroom.
It's been a lot of fun having you.
Thank you.
I wish the time didn't roll by so fast.
That's okay.
Thank you for being here, and you know, we'll have you back.
Thanks, Gina.
And thank you, WROM radio listeners, Detroit internet users, worldwide subscribers. This is Gina Savage. This has been the Red Light Podcast Redux. Thank you, Jim Byrne, and we'll be back next week. Thanks, Victor.
Thank you.
Bye.